At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Julia Alexander. Julia is the director of strategy at Paired Analytics, where she advises clients on the tectonic shifts in tech, media, and telecom. She's also a contributor to Puck, and previously was at TMT and The Verge. I have been reading her stuff at Puck and been enjoying it greatly, and she's a good follow on Twitter if you're into analytics. Streaming data, if you want TV data or whatever we're calling visual medium now, follow her. It's what, at Loudmouth Julia, is that right?
At Loudmouth, yes. Julia. Yeah.
So make sure to follow her. Today we are talking. There's been so much news in the world of streaming that I wanted to get Julia on to talk about what is happening with some of these companies. You know, obviously there's the background on Warner Brothers news, but that is all part and parcel of a big shift in strategy as overseen by their new honcho, right, Julia?
Yeah. So a couple of months ago, a little bit longer than that now, of course, Jason Kilar, who's the former CEO of WarnerMedia, left a bunch of his former executive team, got laid off as new ownership came in, which was David Zaslav, who is now the head honcho of, Warner Brothers Discovery, but used to be the head honcho of just Discovery. And with the new management change comes a tectonic shift in strategy where we're moving away from, we're putting everything into HBO Max and streaming and hoping that that is what will pay off in 5 to 10 years. And now we're going back a little bit to, well, what about theaters? What about cable? And then, of course, what about streaming? We're kind of seeing that divvy up a little bit.
Yeah, because it's interesting how Discovery purchased HBO, right? I mean, they took on $58 billion in debt or something, like some just tragically enormous amount of money that they have taken out in debt to buy the company. But that has changed what they are looking at in terms of spending and what they're willing to lose money on, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got someone in the form of David Zaslav who is relatively shrewd in general and is kind of known for not being a massive spender. If we look at the buildup of the Discovery team just on an employee front, it's very, very lean versus if you look at kind of what WarnerMedia is, especially going back to the Turner days, like you effectively have a company that has a lot of bloat in it that might need a little bit of cutting, which is a really negative way to talk about redundancies in labor and layoff, which is always extremely not bad. But you have someone who's coming in and is going, we have to cut all this spending. We have to figure out how to get our costs down. We have to figure out what type of content to invest in that really works for us dollar per dollar, and what type of content not to invest in. And I think the reason you're hearing a lot more about this right now for a company like Warner Brothers Discovery is, you know, not only do they have a $518 million loss on their streaming product, not only do they have a $3.41 billion loss in general on their quarter for the revenue, but you also have them saying that our projected EBITDA growth, like this, the earnings, the health of this company is going to be missed by $2 billion. And our forecast for what's going to happen over the next half of the year, potentially into the next year, and is going to be really poor. And so all of a sudden, you've got a company who's losing the support of its of Wall Street and of its investors and shareholders really, really fast. The only way to keep them there is to kind of make an appeal to them as opposed to making an appeal to the creative community, right? Jason Kilar could come in and say, we're going to do a bunch of stuff on HBO Max. We're going to greenlight a $70 million Batgirl movie that's going to go to HBO Max. We're going to do something there. We're going to do a Scoob movie or whatever it might be. And you've got Zaslav coming in and saying, we've got to pay off this debt. We have to figure out a way to really ensure for our shareholders that this company is going to be a profitable company, that their revenue is a top concern for us. And so where the brunt of that responsibility comes on is the streaming service. It's them saying, okay, well, we are not necessarily just going to put stuff there and hope that this becomes a profitable business in 2024. We're going to take some pretty drastic cost cutting measurements to make sure that we're both growing our streaming service, but also ensuring that our business is going to grow on top and bottom line at the way that we need it to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated. I've always been fascinated by HBO because it is in a weird way, the perfect entertainment company. You know, if you go, there was a great oral history. I'm looking for the title of the book right now. Tinderbox. There was a great oral history of HBO, a book called Tinderbox. Everyone should check it out if you're interested in HBO. But one thing that got at that I had always kind of understood but never really fully grasped is that HBO is not only a creative powerhouse. Obviously, Sopranos, The Wire, whatever. You know, we all grew up with, you know, it's not TV, it's HBO. But it was also an enormous moneymaker. I mean, just an enormously profitable center of revenue for Time Warner, AOL, you know, going in and out of the various companies that it owned. And trying to figure out how to manage that in the streaming age is Zaslav's hardest priority, right?
Right. And so I think what we should be abundantly clear about is that, you know, while every team is going to be hit by these cost-cutting measures, HBO is probably the most protected. It's the most insulated. Casey Bloys, who's the head of HBO and HBO Max, and his team are the most protected team in Hollywood. So HBO is not necessarily going to be hit in the way that I think a lot of consumers, a lot of fans are looking at. I think where you really are going to see a number of cuts is on the unscripted programming, which to an extent makes sense, right? If we think about what happened with the earnings day, there was a slide that went viral on Twitter, and it was like effectively an advertising slide. And it said HBO Max skews male, Discovery Plus skews female, Discovery Plus skews as a strong retention driver, HBO because of its HBO Max because of its fandoms and because of the HBO programming is a customer acquisition tool. Like, that's what it is. And I feel personally that this became a huge this got taken way out of context, especially by people who work in media and can ask their own companies for advertising decks that show how the websites, their audiences lean. But what that meant to say was like, why would we spend money on a show like whatever it might be, Cooking with Selena or whatever it is, when we have the Food Network? Like, it doesn't make any sense for us to have this huge billions upon billions of dollars of investment in a programming sector that is redundant. But HBO will do, and especially with Casey Bloys, and what will happen with HBO Max, he'll take the scripted side and he'll figure out like, okay, we want to keep Our Flag Means Death, we want to keep Hacks, we want to keep these types of shows that feel like they can still thrive in an HBO environment, but we're going to really cut down on all this other bloated stuff that is either not seeing super high engagement or it's just something that we don't necessarily need because we're doing it better on the unscripted cable side specifically.
Yeah, and moving a lot of that stuff over to Discovery Plus is a smart way to do that. But also, I mean, this brings us to a kind of secondary strategy question, which is I am deeply skeptical of the idea of a single HBO Max Discovery app for reasons that have less to do with economics or anything like that and more to do with how customers see themselves. You know, an HBO Max person does not necessarily see themselves as a flip or flop person. And like, I don't mean there are some who enjoy both. I have been known to indulge in the occasional HGTV show, but like it does feel like two different worlds. But that seems like it's definitely happening, right?
It's absolutely going to happen. I think on the negative side, what they don't want to happen is that you, as an HBO Max subscriber who loves whatever it might be, DC loves HBO, like the reason you're going into this thing, all of a sudden feels really bloated. It starts to feel a lot like Netflix, where you open up Netflix and you're like, none of this feels like quality programming. I don't really know what I want to watch. None of this seems appealing to me. And so you kind of futz around for a little bit and then go somewhere else. Like you go to Hulu or you go somewhere else entirely. That would be the worst thing that could happen. It was that, yeah, somebody who signs up specifically for HBO is now getting placement on their homepage, which is the most, you know, it's the prime real estate in streaming. This gets placement on the homepage for, yeah, Fixer Upper or some Food Channel show or TLC show, whatever it might be. The positive side that can happen, this is what they're betting on, is that in order to build a streaming service at the scale that they want to build it to, I mean, it has to be a four quadrant service. It has to appeal to men and women above 25 and below 25. That requires two different types of programming, and not two different, it requires a bunch of different types of programming, but you really need, again, like your high acquisition drivers and your high retention drivers. So what they're hoping for is you get a family of four or five. Let's just play into dumb gender stereotypes for a second. It's just because that's what's coming to my head. Dad really loves to watch The Sopranos. Mom really loves to watch House Fixer Upper, whatever kid loves, Batman, whatever it might be. All of a sudden, the value perception of that $15 a month skyrockets. When they increase the price of the streaming service, which they will do, it means that they're not going to churn as many customers. And so they can continue acquiring customers and keeping them at a relatively low rate, the cost of acquiring those customers goes down, and all of a sudden they can start to potentially reach profit margins that they are telling the street that they're going to reach. That's the hopeful anticipation, that it will feel like it's an added value, that you're getting what you paid for and then some. The concern, again, is that if you don't manage that correctly, if it doesn't feel curated, if you are not being extremely purposeful in how you're recommending content, which is not just algorithmically, it's also contextually. It is like the way that people engage with a service, the way that humans want to watch stuff. You know, a great thing I always point out to clients, it's like you cannot recommend, I always use The Handmaid's Tale, you cannot recommend another depressing show after The Handmaid's Tale. People don't want to watch it. Like they don't, they've watched their hour, they're thoroughly depressed, they're looking at CNN, they're not going to watch something else. What I would recommend if I'm Hulu is something like Rick and Morty, because they'll stay for a comedy. They got to have a palate cleanser. But the algorithms are not trained to do that. They're trained to be like, you like this show, therefore you might like this show. I always say if you like Criminal Minds, you'll probably like Mindhunter. Like if that's how kind of how they're gonna do it. And so I think if they don't take proper contextual recommendation on the HBO Max side, once they bring in the Discovery products, you do get that bloated feeling. And if that tarnishes the brand, which is all HBO has going for, I mean, it's a great network, but it's built on this reputation of creating great stuff, the way that A24 has built a reputation for itself amongst LA and New York film kids as making like, you know, great movies, film after film after film for the most part. If that's tarnished, it's really hard to change the value perception of that $15. And it's really hard to keep someone if you increase your price.
Just from a pure economic standpoint, why does it make more sense to combine? So I'll just use my household as an example. I subscribe to HBO Max and Discovery Plus. I subscribe to both. And I would assume that if you combine those into one service, the total price is going to end up being less. Like for me, right? But for most people, that's probably not the case. For most people, it'll probably end up being more. But why does it make more sense to combine them into one service, or to say combine Hulu, Disney Plus, and ESPN Plus into a single service, as opposed to offering the option to subscribe to all three at a discounted rate or whatever?
This is, I mean, the big debate, right? This is like, and it really is actually, to your point, like the Disney versus kind of what Warner Brothers is doing debate. With Disney, the reason that they like the idea of having the three different streaming services is that based on what I can understand, one, it leads to the lowest churn rate in the industry. The average churn rate, so people who are kind of canceling, the average churn rate is about 5%. Netflix used to be the lowest for years and years and years, even when they were seeing issues with their programming and other stuff, they still had the lowest churn rate. Now the lowest churn rate is the Disney bundle. It sits at like 2.2%. Mm-hmm. And I think if you think about how they market the Disney bundle, it is like you're paying for two services, you're gonna get one free. That's kind of how they do it. You're gonna pay for Hulu and Disney, you get ESPN Plus kind of thrown in. And so for them, they use that plus the data collection from all those three different services, from three different consumer bases, three different audience bases, that they can then use for the flywheel, which is their whole strategy. Their whole thing is like, we would like Disney Plus to sell Disney park tickets. We would love ESPN Plus to help sell additional merchandise that we may sell, or whatever it is, or go to games that we can figure out a way that keeps the interest in the NFL healthy, that then reflects better with us, and whatever it might be. That is their whole point behind the streaming thing. So they need to kind of have those different customer segments to understand what they're doing, and it keeps retention rates really high. And so they continue to juice their subscriber numbers a little bit, which is maybe not the best way to say it, but they get to count, you know, one subscriber is three, mm-hmm. right? Across the board, they get to say Hulu has gone up this much, even if it hasn't, we don't know. So that's really works for them. I think if you're Discovery Plus, and the last thing I'll say on that is both Hulu and Disney Plus, especially Hulu now with the FX kind of stuff thrown in, are equally big selling points to customers. So for them, it's like we can generate a stronger average revenue per user, ARPU, if we have these kind of three bundle, the bundle rather, with the three streaming services. If you're discovering your HBO Max, Discovery Plus is a much harder product to scale. For as broad as it is, it's actually a relatively niche audience who's going to be signing up. That audience also tends to be older. They tend to still be in cable. They're not falling off the cable cliff and cord cutting as fast as others. So Discovery Plus is kind of the service that's doing well for the operational cost that it is, but it's not going to be huge. But if you bring that into HBO Max, you get to solve HBO Max's churn issues, or potentially solve HBO Max's churn issues, and you help to create a four quadrant service without the necessary additional investment that HBO Max would need. Again, we come back to like, they made Cooking with Selena. They made all these shows because they didn't have the unscripted stuff that Discovery does have. So to bring it in, you create a really wholesome streaming service that has the ability to scale that the other one really doesn't. And so it just makes better sense for them versus Disney has two really in-demand streaming services. ESPN Plus is growing. Actually, I was just told by a friend over there that they should have a pretty strong earnings on the ESPN Plus side in a couple hours as we're recording this. You know, that's kind of growing at the rate that they want it to. And that's really based on the bundle option. That is like the ability to bring the, give that people for free. So it's just a different, you look at your services and you kind of debate what your overarching goal is, whether it's data collection for other stuff, whether it is to create a truly scalable global product, like whatever it might be, there's a different approach to each one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, my big concern for HBO Max, which is my favorite, you know, service, is mostly that people will be like, well, I don't want to subscribe to HBO Max. I'm not a Discovery person. That's not what I do, which I think is very possible. All right. So I want to bring up, speaking of HBO Max, let's bring it back to the big news from last week. All right. Which was the shelving of Batgirl. Zaslav says we're going to take a tax write down on this instead of finishing the FX work or putting it in theaters. But explain the business sense for folks who cannot understand why it's better to just not publish a thing or not show people a thing that they have already made and paid for than to show it to them.
Yeah. So, and there's a lot of healthy debate about this. So the key word here is amortization. And so there is this ability, there's this brief window because new management is coming in. They get this brief window legally and from an accounting perspective where they can write down a bunch of projects from the former company that will then effectively give them a tax break. So when they look at a film like Batgirl, and then this is where all the asterisks come in, right? Like, okay, how bad was this movie that they're not going to release it? And for them, you know, a $70 million movie that, let's say with marketing and some reshoots and whatever it might be, becomes an $80, $90 million movie, that has one major goal if it's going to HBO Max. It is one goal, and it is to acquire customers. It is like, you need to bring in 2 million subscribers in order for us to really see the revenue potential. I mean, this is a whole debate, Sunny, which I know you know, about like theatrical versus streaming in general, right? This ongoing thing. So the asterisks are, is how bad was this movie that you're not going to release it? How close to being done was it that like you're not just going to bring it across the finish line? What does this do to the relationship with talent? Like that alone, and you saw that the directors of those movies post a screenshot from like Kevin Feige, who emailed them and was like, we sounds like hell over there. Sorry about that. Like, we still love you. Hope to work with you more. You know, what does that do that might be irreparable, that does harm your bottom line down the in the future? All of these are questions that I would argue previous management would have said, like, we don't know what's going to happen with this movie, but let's take a shot on it, which I also feel is very HBO in general. Like, where HBO, if we think about shows that they've greenlit, or, you know, even through Game of Thrones, we're kind of like, we don't know if this is going to be a thing that's going to do well, but like, let's try it. Like, let's see what we can do with it. We believe in the talent. Zaslav is the other side of it. Zaslav is someone who's like, we don't think this movie is going to be very successful for us. Also, we then have to continue paying month after month to have that movie on our platform. This is like how you last week there were reports that a bunch of titles were being removed from HBO Max. It's because they have to pay for it. They have to pay month after month for it to have those titles on it, even from HBO and from Warner. Like, they still have to pay for it. And so you have Zaslav, who's effectively modeling this in Excel with his team. And he's going, okay, based on what we think about this movie and its subscribers, based on all this other stuff that's going on, do we think this movie is going to be profitable for us, even break even? And my guess is that the numbers were so poor, and Zaslav is so focused on this kind of cost cutting situation, that he was like, it's actually better to take advantage of this one opportunity we have to at least generate some meaningful tax break that brings, you know, that helps us with our bottom line, which is cutting debt, than try to release it. I think the issue, you know, for Zaslav, who spent months when the deal was first announced between Discovery and Warner Media, of him going out to town with talent saying, we're going to theaters, we're going back to theaters, we really want the best talent. Like, you've come and done that. And then the first, you know, four or five months that he's overseeing this company, all of a sudden he's making these decisions that aren't necessarily talent friendly in the eyes of the press, in the eyes of talent. And so that's a really difficult situation to be in, because on the one hand, from a business sense, it might be more economical. It probably is more economical to say, like, we don't think this movie's going to do super well, so we're just going to take this this opportunistic tax write down, this one-time offer that we have because of the legality of how mergers work, and we're going to be able to kind of move forward and focus on projects that, you know, a direct-to-streaming movie is going to be a $10 million movie. This is where Netflix's bread and butter is. It's a $10 million movie that generates really strong engagement with audiences or whatever it might be, or strong retention, whatever it might be. Instead of doing the $70 million movie, if we're making a $70 million movie, that movie better be good enough to go to theaters. But he's alienated, I think, some talent in the process. And if I'm Casey Bloys, that's my big concern. Mm-hmm. That is, like, if we don't play the talent game at the cost that sometimes talent needs, and I'm not saying that Batgirl should have been a $70 million movie. If you got a movie with Michael Keaton as Batman, like, you're not going to put, like, it's a weird thing to happen. But I think if you're Casey Bloys, you're hyper aware of two things. One, you're HBO and your reputation is built on being home for talent and supportive to talent and putting out really great stuff. And two, you're hyper aware that if you don't do it, there's a great team at Apple who has all the money in the world who will do it happily. And so I think that's kind of the situation where the economical sense, it does make sense. Like, that, it's really unfair, but it does make sense in the short term. And this is where you see Disney kind of going, like, we're going to take the short term hit because we need to focus on the long term. What this did long term economically to the potential for Zaslav and talent going forward, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I want to pull back to one thing you mentioned briefly, because I think it's worth hitting on, and I haven't seen a lot of people talk about it. You know, there was some news last week that some HBO original series like Vinyl, you know, the pilot of which was directed by Martin Scorsese, was pulled off of HBO Max, a bunch of other titles, and people were like, oh my God, these things are disappearing. You know, where will I be able to watch an American Pickle in the future? And you know, as somebody who is a collector of physical media, I did get to say, I told you so. You know, if you love something, you need to own it. But like, but there is an actual economic reason for doing this, and I don't think people understand the licensing fees that HBO Max and Warner Brothers were paying for these movies and these television shows.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big exclusivity play, right? Is like, we're going to take all these short-term hits because we're not licensing it out, we're not making that money. And instead, what they're saying is, we're going to have to pay that licensing money. Think of it when Project Popcorn happened with Jason Klar and Warner Media and HBO Max, and they said, we're going to take 17 movies and release them in theaters on HBO Max the same day. It wasn't like they said, cool, we're going to go to theaters and this is free for us on the HBO Max front. HBO had to pay Warner Brothers to have access, or HBO Max had to pay Warner Brothers to have access to the first run of those films. It was an expensive bet, like, even internally. I mean, yes, on the one hand, you're saying, like, money is changing hand from here to here, but each different department has their own profit and loss that they oversee. They have their own budget. So it's an actual expense. If you're not seeing, and this is where, like, I mean, I talk about this on Twitter a lot, like, what we're effectively talking about with streaming, which we didn't do as much in broadcast because the economic structure was so different, mainly because of advertising and how that affected a bunch of TV shows and films and pay one windows. What you're seeing with streaming is the dollar per dollar content valuation of a title is going to become the number one question for any title that's going to be on a service, how long it runs, whether they pick it up, whether they give it to another service. This will be the number one question. It's just like, okay, well, how much money is this title generating us? And that comes down to two things. Is it keeping our subscribers retained 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 120 days after we have it? Is it bringing in new subscribers? If it's not accomplishing those goals, what is its value? Now, you say that to people who love, and including myself, people who love to watch movies and TV shows and want access to everything. And that's a really daunting thing to say, which is like, if it's not valuable, it could just disappear from streaming. I mean, it's still available on VOD. They'll still be available to buy. But the idea is, like, if they're not being engaged with and they're sitting on the shelf, they are actually not just collecting dust. They're paying for this to collect dust, and they could be and they could give it out elsewhere. They could say, like, our audience isn't into American Pickle, but Netflix might be into it, and they'll pay for this, and then we make money off of them. What I think you'll see happen, and what should have happened with Netflix a long time ago, and it just didn't, is they have these titles that don't do super well. Netflix has removed some of its originals. It's like usually international, but they've done this too. They'll remove some from their platform. They should launch free advertisement supported platforms and take some of these titles and partner with a Roku, partner with a Google, whoever it is, who have the fast channels, with a Pluto, and say, like, we're going to launch the Netflix free channel, the HBO free channel. Like, we're going to launch this thing. And it's going to be titles that are not doing well on our thing, but someone who's not paying for content, the value perception of watching something is totally different. So they might say, hey, I'll watch American Pickle if it's on my Roku or whatever it is, like, I'll watch it. And they can generate ad revenue through that, and they're no longer in charge of the distribution. Now it's like Roku, and now it's Pluto who are in charge of the distribution. They're the ones who have it set up. So they're generating that incremental income. They're not giving it away to competitors, and they're kind of within this very, very quickly building ecosystem of fast, that's what we call it, of customers who are watching a lot of free ad-supported television. And I think we'll see a lot more of that come to play. But yeah, I would not be surprised if you hear about more movies and TV shows leaving HBO Max, leaving Hulu, leaving others, because they do have to pay month after month, year after year, to have those on the service, even if it's from their own studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and this is also there's a question here also of paying for the talent too, because I mean this is where residuals come from. This is where all that stuff, you know. So if you want to have that sort of thing on HBO Max, you have to pay somebody to have it. Your point about what is the individual value of this individual movie to the service is a very key one. And I want to look at two recent films from Netflix. Right. So Netflix famously releases The Gray Man a couple weeks ago, and it, you know, gets a cursory 7-day run in theaters, but it is really just going to Netflix. And, you know, they talked about, oh yeah, 200 million people watch it, whatever, 85 million hours, whatever the number was. But the movie, again, movie costs $200 million to make, right? It costs probably another $30, $40 million on advertising. So in the first 10 days, if it's watched by, you know, for 185 million hours, that's good. That's good. But it's like the fifth best ever. It's not like amazing. Then you have a movie like Purple Hearts. So Purple Hearts, nobody's talking about Purple Hearts. We don't have think pieces about Purple Hearts. There's not, you know, memes about Purple Hearts, maybe somewhere, I don't know, on Instagram, I don't know. But Purple Hearts movie costs about $10 million, let's say. I don't know for sure, but let's say in the $10 to $15 million range. They spend nothing on advertising for it. It just shows up on the home screen, and it does 151 million hours, right? So you have a movie that costs, let's say, just for the sake of argument, let's say it costs 10% as much to make. But it still generates 80% of the eyeballs. Why is Netflix spending $200 million on a movie that is only getting them another, you know, 20% bump in eyeballs? I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me as a business proposition.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix's blockbuster strategy in general doesn't make much sense to me either. What I will say is, I had talked to a friend at Netflix who worked within film, and we were talking about titles like Purple Hearts and Kissing Booth and movies like that, and the Christmas movies. And they were like, that's our bread and butter. Those movies overperform in ways you would not imagine. Like, they just are extremely good at doing what they do, and they cost a tenth, a 20th of what we're doing on the big blockbuster stuff. And the way that I kind of think about it, I don't know if this is accurate, but the way I think about it is, if anyone who's listening has worked in a newsroom, you sometimes get newer employees who come in and they're writing blog posts, or they're reblogging stuff. They're kind of just putting stuff up on the site, has to go up on the site. And in an ad kind of supported media environment, you're doing it because the more people you have coming to your website, better ads you can get. Like, it's kind of how it works. And also, by doing that, it allows the features writers to kind of go off and chase a Pulitzer. They get to go off and be like, I'm going to spend 6 months doing this thing, because they know that the feature, once it comes out, may generate a lot of hits or whatever you want, like a lot of people reading it. But it's not going to be the day-to-day thing that keeps the website going, that keeps people employed. And I think about this a lot with Netflix's movie strategy, where they need the $5 to $10 million movie that does the insane numbers that it does, that travels on TikTok. And this is where Purple Heart seems to really be thriving, is like on TikTok. It's not a Twitter movie. It's definitely a TikTok movie. People are watching it and they're creating additional content, which is earned media for the company. And so you have them, and they do what they do. They keep people subscribed. They keep people watching. That Netflix gets to say, like, we have this usage. We feel pretty good. It's bringing in some new subscribers. That's awesome. Also, though, we want to be a home for talent. So we do these movies to pay Martin Scorsese to do The Irishman, you know, a movie that is phenomenal, but also know their studio is going to do it. Like, they're like, we can't afford to do it. We're not going to do this. And Netflix goes, okay, well, we have all these these movies no one's talking about on Twitter, or but they're being heavily watched. And so we can do this movie. You know, we need a huge franchise. We know that we kind of want to get into theatrical. We know that we want to get into gaming. We know that we want big franchises to compete with Disney and Warner Brothers. So we're going to partner with the guys who did it for Disney. We're going to partner with the Russo brothers and their production company. We're going to spend the money on it, because then we're going to greenlight the sequel and the anime spinoff and whatever might be in the game. And then we're going to have a franchise that hopefully we can sell merchandise for and target. Like, that's kind of their thinking, is like, we have to start taking these bets on it, and we're going to do it at the price that they need. So how do you do that? You have Purple Hearts. You say, we're going to make these movies that also are, like, you know, I don't think anyone on those teams, on those production teams, would be happy with me saying, like, you exist to make sure this other movie happens. I'm sure, I haven't seen it, but a quality movie, or at least an entertaining movie in its own right. Like that, it's its own thing, and it has an audience, and that's phenomenal. I think the smartest thing Netflix ever did coming up, outside of getting very good into original television content, was looking at the theatrical landscape around 2015, 2014, and saying, there's nothing here for young women. Like, there's just nothing happening out here. It's all superheroes, which tend to be young men. There are women, obviously, who are into them, but tends to be young men. And Netflix went out and did Tall the Boys I Love Before and The Kissing Booth. And all of a sudden, they've got huge, huge young adult teen audience, women who don't cancel. They're there. They're saying, awesome. Works out super well for them. And so I think Netflix learns from this and goes, like, we can do these what are called taste clusters. We can do these movies for different taste clusters at an insanely cheap price that has pretty strong engagement, and that really keeps the service up and running, and keeps people, it brings in a little bit of subscribers, not as many as before, but really retains them, which is why we see the low churn rate. And then we're going to take the big bet. We can't do the big bet without the support. And this is actually kind of Zaslav's thing, right? Like, he wants to do the streaming, but his thing is, like, if our stock gets downgraded, if we lose the shareholder backing and the investment backing, we can't do this. Like, it's just, we won't have the money for it. We have to be able to put money into it. That means we have to make money, and we make money on movies and theaters. I don't know if The Gray Man would have made, you know, $500 million, but it definitely would have made some kind of money if it was released theatrically. And so I think Netflix, when they're looking at it, again, it's that. It is like, we want to do the big thing. We need to be able to support the big thing and not be in the red as much as we are. So we make 10 of these $5 million movies that do pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the strategy Netflix has appealing to younger women quadrant makes tons of sense to me. Mm-hmm. And going after the Oscar movies makes a ton of sense to me, right? Going after Roma or The Irishman or whatever, funding that. Makes sense. Everybody likes prestige. Everybody wants prestige. Mm-hmm. I get that. It is those Gray Man style movies, Red Notice, you know, et cetera, that I just don't quite, they don't jump out to me as things that make a lot of sense. I guess unless, as you say, they are planning a big move into theatrical or merchandising, that sort of thing.
You know where they do? Do you know where it does make sense? And I was thinking about this. I was talking to a friend and I was like, oh, you know, we were kind of mulling over this point. I said, there might be something to this. One, those movies have global film stars. And two, those movies are super easy to watch, even if you're not, it's not in English. Yep. Those movies are like, big action thing happens, global movie star that everyone knows. It's like, so they watch it. If you're Netflix and your goal is not necessarily the United States anymore, it is like, yeah, we've saturated. But we want to get into India. We want to get into South Korea. We want to get into these things where they love the big Western film star, the Ryan Reynolds, the Dwayne Johnson, the Gal Gadot. You do the movies because you're like, hey, we think that this is going to have a stronger return for us globally. And we need the movies that are big action movies that we can dub. Obviously, we're going to dub the dialogue and we can sub the dialogue, but also are like pretty easy to watch, which is what they are. They're like, they're easy movies to watch. I wouldn't say they're memorable. This is my main issue with any type of major blockbuster Netflix's release, is I can't remember any part from any of them. And so I think with Netflix, it is like, does this travel well? And cool. If it gets viewership in the US, awesome. Like, that's our main area in terms of revenue. Like, that's great. But their biggest concern now is not the US. I mean, I think it should be. But their biggest concern is like, cool, we have to continue growing in Latin America, in the United Europe, Middle East, Africa, and Asia. And that's their thing. And I think those movies and those global film stars that cost a lot of money and their brands onto themselves do that. And now I still think it's bizarre to me to take a $200 million movie and not put it in theaters. Like, even especially because it's a 45-day window. Like, it's not a huge window anymore. It's like, you just go out the way everyone else is doing it. And the exhibitors at this point, let's be honest, right? The exhibitors at this point are like desperate enough that if you were to be like, we're gonna do 35 days, I'm sure they would come down. And they're like, we just need movies, like, sure, whatever. So I think for Netflix, that move will happen relative, you know, not in the immediate future, but the next, I would say like 18 months, two years. But I think, again, like this, the only aspect of that release strategy that makes any sense to me, or the acquisition strategy for that content, is that it plays well globally. Mm-hmm. And they need that more than anything on the film front.
Yeah. You mentioned merchandising. Why is Netflix so bad at merchandising? I mean, I like, you know, maybe you were writing or somebody was writing about, but Sandman, they've got Sandman out, and Sandman is a toyable franchise or a plushable, funkoable franchise, something. And there's just nothing. There's nothing for it. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, with Sandman, let's get the, I was just reading about this in Puck, but with the acknowledgement that it's Warner Brothers television production, right. So maybe Warner Brothers retained the ancillary rights to it when they sold it or whatever it might be, who knows. If we take that out of the equation, because I think you're asking a very important question, like, what is the overall strategy for Netflix's merchandising? You know, if they want to create a flywheel effect, like, everybody's trying to follow Disney, which is funny because Disney's trying to follow Netflix. Everyone's trying to follow Disney, and they're kind of saying, like, we want to have this, you know, self-fulfilling revenue cycle where everything helps each other out. Think of it like an Ouroboros head or snake. Then merchandising is a really key part of it, because merchandising is not just ancillary revenue, right? It's not just like, I bought a t-shirt, Netflix makes $4. It is, hey, I bought a t-shirt because I love Stranger Things. Like, it's my show of adoration, right? It's like, mm-hmm. it's what it is. And that form of adoration is monetizable. This is the worst thing you can say to creatives, but you can monetize love. Like, that's what they're trying to do on the finance side. Like, they're trying to monetize that exact love. Therefore, merchandising is super important. I think the issue, and I was talking to a pal of mine who works at Disney within consumer products, and there's two main issues. One, they don't have an actual leader at Netflix who understands, I think, consumer products very, as well as the team at Disney. Two, I think they are they're trying to kind of do everything. Like, they have the Walmart deal, they have the Target deal, but also they have a shop that's like very A24. It's like, we're going to partner with like streetwear brands and like companies, and we're going to try to do limited drops. But three, and this is the biggest issue with almost all of Netflix stuff, there is no marketing for it. You got to seek it out. I was on the Netflix shop the other day because I was trying to see if there was Sandman stuff. There was all this really dope Stranger Things merchandise that like is not at Walmart. Like, it's very specific limited edition. And no one knows about it. And I was talking to my friend Casey Moore, who runs What's on Netflix, super smart Netflix analyst type guy. And he was looking at the traffic for the site. He's like, yeah, the site gets like 1,000 hits a month. Like, no one is going to see what Netflix has. They're not marketing it. Netflix cut a big part of their marketing team. So I think there's this issue of like, Netflix is not in the merchandising game as much as they should be. Two, they don't really know how to lead that segment. They don't really know what they're doing in that segment, in my opinion. And then three, they're not marketing what they do have. Like, they're not out here being like, we've got a bunch of Squid Game stuff, we have a bunch of Bridgerton stuff, like whatever it might be. And so people are like, why would I buy? If we think about what A24 does, A24, I mean, it's a small company, but those drops, they have the audience. Like, they're hyper, the audience is very aware of when stuff comes out. And then if you think about the best in class on the consumer product side, I mean, it's Disney. And Disney is like, what Disney does extremely well is Disney partners with almost everyone. Almost anyone can use Mickey Mouse at this point. And they're like, yeah, H&M wants to do it. Great, put Mickey on a shirt. A rug company wants to put the Star Wars logo on, cool, put it on. Because in their mind, the more people stare at something or they wear something or they play with something, the stronger the admiration is for the overall brand. So they'll go watch the movies and their kids will watch the movies. And so they have this kind of world where they get to dominate attention 24/7. You know, it's a lot, but it works. It works extremely well for them. And so I think with Netflix, they're not doing that, and there doesn't seem any inclination to really do it. And even acknowledging that their method of approaching any type of launch for any type of product is walk, crawl, run. They've had enough time to walk. They've had enough time to sit on it and kind of be like, okay, what's our next move here? And then let's really launch. And then we haven't really seen anything come of it. So it just feels like a mess. Like, I wish I had an answer that was like, here's exactly what's happening with there. And I was like, I don't. I have no idea what they're doing. And it's very odd because we live in a moment where, for better or for worse, people's identity are tied to their movies and their TV shows. Like, people love it. Like, the TikTok identities from teens are built on being Succession stan accounts or whatever it might be. they want to buy stuff. And where are they buying it? They're going to Etsy. Like, they're going to, like, yeah. these, right? So, I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird. I want to shift gears slightly and talk about analytics. Your day job is explaining to people what everyone is watching. And the thing that I hear from a lot of folks, and frankly, I say this sometimes myself, mm-hmm. that just isn't true, is we don't know how many people are watching things.
Right.
How do we know? Explain to me how you guys figure out what is being watched by who and when.
So for us specifically over at Parrot Analytics, we look at, to be fully transparent, we're not plugged into any of the services. Like, I cannot tell you how many people are watching Gray Man. Like, could not tell you exactly that number. And I will say that none of the services, Nielsen, Antenna, no matter who it is, will have better information than the services, right? Like, that's right. Like, no one's going to try to sell to them as that option. What we look at specifically is a bunch of different things, going from like social interaction at the very bottom of how we rank our demand expression, all the way to consumption via piracy. And the reason that we rely on piracy a lot is because I was talking to a friend who works at a major streaming company in the Netherlands. Today I was talking to him, and he's like, I can't get The Offer. He's like, I really want to watch The Offer. And he's like, I had to stream it. And I said, how often do you do that? And he said, for most things, because we don't have the services. We don't get the shows. And so when we launched years ago, a decade ago, our thing was, half my team for Parrot Analytics is in New Zealand. And they weren't getting anything. They were like, we want to watch stuff and we can't get it. And we looked at the piracy numbers and they are like insanely high, and it's never been easier. Like, you just hit mm-hmm. play on something. So what we do is we take consumption from that with a bunch of other consumption metrics, and then we create a demand expression. And then for that demand expression basically says, like, here is what is very in demand. And then we have, there's a statistics nerds will love this. There's something called R squared. And so if you might have heard it, well, people talk about the economy recently. R squared is basically like, what is the one-to-one relationship between this thing and this thing? And so if the R squared is like 0.7, it's pretty high. It means that there's a pretty strong correlation between this thing happening and then this thing happening. Our correlation between demand and Netflix subscriber growth was 0.99, which is like unheard of. So we basically were like, our demand for your shows is directly one-to-one with how many subscribers you're adding or losing every single quarter. Like, we can mm-hmm. see that happening. So that's what we do. We are like, and not to make this sound like a sale, we are one of many companies doing things. Antenna specifically looks at credit card usage for activations and cancellations for streaming services to get an idea of like what people are interested in churn-wise. Nielsen obviously is plugged into viewership, but Nielsen is, you know, slightly antiquated in how they're approaching it. So they're trying to figure their stuff out. All of us, I would say, are complementary to each other. You kind of take all of the data, as much data. I know that you know entertainment strategy guy, like, you take as much data as you can get and then try to create a picture. But I will say the one thing that I really stress when I'm thinking about how I do my job, whether it's writing for Puck or whether it's my actual day job, and then when I talk to other people, Casey, Brandon Katz, who's a great reporter, Frank Plato's at CNN, who's been on the podcast, or whoever it might be, entertainment strategy guy, viewership is very important. It's consumption, and consumption is the best form of engagement. It's why we weight it the highest. Like, it's very important. It is not the only metric that matters to streaming in the way that it mattered to broadcast and cable, right? Like, it was on broadcast, especially, it was this many people in this demographic are watching something, and therefore the advertisements coming in are really great. And then we use the advertisements to get the show to season 5, and then we syndicate. Like, there was a whole strategy that they did, and it was reliant on advertising. Nielsen was created to help advertisers. Like, it was mm-hmm. a big part of it. With streaming, the question of a show, they get something like Friends, right? The question of a show with Friends is not necessarily going to pop into a top 20 chart on Nielsen every single week, because there's just not that many people watching Friends over and over again. But it is the reason, we look at something called like a decay rate. A decay rate just means like how high is the demand when there's no new season of a show. And Friends has an extremely low decay rate, which means people are keeping HBO Max because they have Friends. You know, mm-hmm. people are keeping Netflix because they have New Girl or like whatever it might be. They go back and they watch the show. And as long as that show is there, then they'll pay for the service. That is kind of the biggest value proposition of that title. We talk about the value of content. Like, that is what that title is really valuable for. And so I think when we look at viewership, especially for new titles, where the question is like, okay, cool, this show, I don't know, 10 million people watch the show in the first 20 days and the first 30 days. The questions Netflix asks, if you ever get to see a Netflix board for how they look at their shows data-wise, they have a bunch of different charts. And at the very top, they have an efficiency rating and then a value for the show that they assign to it. And then the charts below all create the efficiency rating. The efficiency rating is based on how many people watched 70% of the show, 100% of the show, how many people there then watched another Netflix original, how many people then watched a licensed title that Netflix had the rights, has the rights to, how many, what was the sentiment of the people who watched it, the like, dislike, whatever it might be, what was the sentiment of it? And it creates an efficiency rating. And if the efficiency rating needs to be pretty high for Netflix to consider it a success, right? And so they look at this on a per title basis, and then it creates the value. And I think that's a big part of how streaming is, which is, okay, cool. People came in for this title. That's awesome. Are they a one-point purchase? Are they going to cancel it in 2 weeks because they're over it? Or did this title bring people in and then they were watching Friends and then they were watching something else? Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Like how do we use all that? So I think that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, is talking to executives on the OTT side about that, and then producers on the creative side about how they should be going into these negotiations for renewals or whatever it might be, and what they should be armed with data-wise. I always say, I tell them, like, you can't just ask for viewership. You might get something. They might give you a number, but that's not what the only thing that matters to them. Like, that you could have a huge show. If 90% of the people who you brought in churned, like canceled the week later, that show's not going to get renewed. Like, it's just not going to happen. It doesn't make sense for the OTT platform. But your show came in, didn't have huge numbers, but it's seeing incremental growth. It's holding pretty steady at a solid rate for 120 days. That show's going to get renewed. Like, it's just good what's going to happen. And so understanding those metrics, I think, is so important on both sides.
So when Ben Stiller complains about not getting any numbers for Severance, he's looking at the wrong thing. Unless he's specifically looking for, you know, How many more people went to go watch, you know, C afterwards?
and it's like, I never want to play down like viewership, because it's still a huge part of what we look at too. We call it, it's consumption for us, you know, how many people are actually watching. Because people actually sitting down to watch something for 10 episodes or whatever it might be, like, that's a huge thing. Like, it's like, cool, this is actual intent to watch, and it is watch, versus like this may show intent to watch, but they don't watch. Someone who retweets a trailer or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I think the first question should always be, how many people watch? Absolutely. But there should be other questions that are like, okay, well, and this is what will come up really in all the new backend deals as new contracts are being created. It will be like, well, how many subscribers did I help you retain as a whole in your quarter with this title? How many subscribers did I, oh, another big one. How many subscribers did I bring in from an audience demographic that you are currently trying to penetrate? Like, what, like, you, every Disney Plus doesn't have a strong above 40 crowd. That should be obvious to anyone. Disney Plus wants to be a huge scalable service. You know, you have to appeal to above 40. It's like your Hamilton moment. You really need to appeal to your above 40. Cool. So if your show that is, I don't know, a procedural brings in that audience, they bring in dads and moms who are at home watching something together on a Wednesday night, that title is going to be more valuable in many ways than another Star Wars title. It's not going to bring in huge subscribers. It's going to retain them, but it's not going to do huge. If your show brings in a bunch and keeps them, and it's a different demographic, which is what Hamilton did, the value of that title increases. And if you're a producer, if you're Ben Stiller, you want to know that. You want to know, like, cool, I'm actually doing a lot for you. You know, you're Jason Sudeikis. How much is Ted Lasso doing for the sentiment of this platform? How much is Ted Lasso actually making people think, oh, Apple TV Plus may be valuable to me, and therefore I will sign up for it? So these are questions you'd have to ask with broadcasting, where the only question was, how many people are watching it? In what demographic are they watching it? Great. Like, cool. Like, there's an audience. I'm really excited. The advertisers are really happy. Like, that's awesome. On streaming, there's a much larger picture to what is considered success.
But the streamers aren't going to want to give any of that up, right? Yeah. I mean, I talk to folks mostly with writers who are terrified of a new strike.
Yeah.
They're basically, the Writers Guild is like, we're probably going to strike because we want more money from the streamers. Totally reasonable. You know, writers are getting shafted in all sorts of ways with small writers rooms, whatever. But like, what they actually want are good analytics, and that's like the thing that the streamers will fight to the death to never give anyone.
That's exactly right. And until there's one or two things that will force their hand. One, not like a law per se, but like literally some kind of ruling that is like, you have to disclose this for equal for unfair grounds. Like, you has to be a thing you have to do, right? Like, I was going to compare it to box office results, but studios were the ones actually who were reporting those back in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a different situation. Or two, to your point, it's the guilds who will try to, the unions will try to force their hand. The only issue with the unions, which I'm sure a lot of the writers you speak to are very aware of, like, I'm very pro-union, I worked in the unionized environment for a long, long time, is that unions take a long time to get things done. It's a long process, it's back and forth, and in that time, a lot of people aren't working, a lot of people, it becomes a whole situation. And if you're a company like Netflix, you don't necessarily, there are other ways you make shows, right? Like, you find a way around, it's not a great way to do it, but you find a way to kind of continue making content, and it's not super great, but that's what happens. And so I think it needs a combination of both. I do think we are going to see a strike. If it's not the WGA, it'll be some other kind. I think, you know, I also think SAG-AFTRA should come out and be like, we want to be aware of what this is. The PGA should come out, right? Think of the producers. Producers are the ones who are trying to argue and, like, be in those negotiation rooms. I think they should come out and say it. It's your exact point, Sunny. If you are, you know, I think I was tweeting this about the Ben Stiller thing. If you are in a position of power, why would you give anyone any room or any added leverage in the bargaining table, right? Like, you just wouldn't. It doesn't make any sense. And you can say that you're pro talent as a company. You can say that you're whatever. The only duty the public companies have is a fiduciary duty. They only have to make money. They just have to continue making money, and they have to continue increasing their profit margins and cutting costs. And so part of the way to do that is by being in negotiation rooms and not giving out too much data. Because if you give out too much data, then people get to come back and say, like, we want to negotiate for a better rate, for a better pay. Now, you get some networks who are notoriously very good for this, right? Like HBO. HBO is very, very good. They don't give out money numbers, but they tend to be fair with the negotiations. They tend to whatever. I'm not trying to say that any company is not fair, but I do think you'll start to see a lot more like what we saw with Disney and Scarlett Johansson, where there was a lawsuit and she was like, you know, again, like, what is my back end profit on this movie that now helps you bring in a bunch of people to Disney Plus, whatever it might be. That is where you'll start to see the idea of valuing content, the idea of being able to give someone a number and be like, hey, like, here's what your show does in this demographic, and here's the monetary value of it, and here's why we think, or who we might pair it, Nielsen, Antenna, whoever it might be, here's why we might think that your show is really strong on Apple, and here's what Apple really needs to give you because of whatever. And on the other front, you give the same kind of report or whatever it might be, or and they're doing them internally already at the companies, but you have your company like Apple, you're looking at the value of this title and you're looking at how it compares to the value of other titles, and you're trying to keep that close to your chest, right? And I think what you'll see on the valuation side from the OTT players is they'll start to kind of look at what the value of that title is to them versus what it can be sold at. So Manifest, right? Manifest, mm-hmm. Peak, mm-hmm. NBC gave it to Netflix for a pretty cheap price. Didn't think anything of it. Wasn't doing super well on NBC. Didn't think it was going to do super well on Peacock. Goes to Netflix, boom, right? Like, huge show. All of a sudden, Netflix is like, we're going to get a fourth season out of it. We're going to end it. It's great for us. If you're NBC, if you kind of knew what the value of that title would be on a Netflix before you sold it, you can have a higher negotiation fee. So we're going to, in the economics of how business is done in Hollywood is going to change. I mean, not hugely, but the way we kind of value stuff is going to start to change pretty rapidly. And, like, that's one, I mean, exciting for someone in my position who just likes numbers and data and likes to talk about these things. But it does mean that the producers and the creatives need to arm themselves with something that gets them into those rooms and gives them a fair ground to stand on, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. This is everything. I actually still have like five questions left, but we're coming up on an hour here, so I'm gonna just close with my standard closing question. What should I have asked? What did I fail to ask? What do you think people should know about what's going on in the world of entertainment and streaming and analytics and all that stuff?
There's something that is affecting three of the biggest players in coming into streaming that is going to become a huge topic of conversation, and it's going to change. And for our listeners on who are listening to this, who might not necessarily care about the financial side of it, who don't care about a term like EBITDA, it is going to impact kind of content investment and therefore trickle down to what you're seeing. The companies it doesn't affect necessarily, Netflix, Apple, Amazon, doesn't affect these companies. Warner Brothers Discovery, Paramount, NBC Universal, they had something, so there's something called profit margins. The profit margins they made on cable and on broadcast were insanely high. Insanely high. It's why they became as lucrative as they became. Discovery is another one. Insanely high margins on it. They're looking at a future where those profit margins are like half of what they were doing, and they are trying to find a way to make peace with that future while also moving into the future and trying to figure out how we get close to it. that's a really daunting thing for a cable company to try and figure out. Well, they're still losing money on streaming, and they're going to be losing money on streaming for a little bit of time. So the thing I always recommend, and I know it sounds a little bit like homework, but if you pay attention to earnings and you pay attention to the right questions that the analysts are going to ask, which are all about profit margin, it's all about kind of the health of what they're making versus what they're spending, the cost of a customer acquisition, you'll get an idea of how that might play out in terms of content, where they're going to invest in certain content. And so I always recommend, as someone who loves data, but also someone who was like a consumer person first, I consume TV and film. Like, I came up over at Polygon, like reviewing movies and TV shows and like writing about this stuff. The more you kind of know about that, the more you'll be able to understand why things are about to happen the way that they are about to happen. And it's just advice I give to anyone I've been thinking about it, because in the last earnings call at WBD, there were a lot of people who didn't understand finance, which is fine. Like, not like more or less people should understand finance, in my opinion. But it was a rumor. It was like, what does this matter? How does this affect it? And the more that you kind of spend time with that, like reading a CNBC article on it, whatever it might be, the better idea you'll have of what is going to happen and why it's going to happen, and how Disney, Paramount, NBC Universal, and Warner Brothers Discovery are going to have to change things at a very scary point for the executives. And for investors who are used to like 40, 50 years of unprecedented level of just success in and economic success in entertainment, and are now going into a very daunting, almost irrevocable moment. So that's what I would say.
Well, I just to follow up on this briefly, I mean, you excluded specifically Apple, Amazon, and Netflix from this. But let's set Netflix aside because it has its own thing. I mean, Amazon and Apple are basically playing with a cheat code.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to make money on these services. They are all just adjuncts of like the larger iPhone production or, you know, shipping movies to people, you know, business, right? Like how are the other streaming services, the other networks supposed to compete with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, good luck is kind of a thing. But I think, you know, with Amazon, and we can look at the reasons for why these exist, right? Tim Cook gets a very scary presentation from a McKinsey consultant in 2014, 2015 that says your hardware is slowing down. Oh, like your Apple, it's terrifying, your hardware company. So Tim Cook and his CFO, Luca Maestri, they get together and they say, well, services, recurring revenue. They're looking at Netflix. They're looking at Xbox Live. They're looking at these things and they're like, these, you know, Xbox is a hardware company. Then now is a very successful software company, PlayStation. Now they're looking at this and they're saying, we can do that. We have hardware. We have a built-in thing. So they launch kind of all these different Apple services, right? Music, news, fitness, and then TV Plus. And the idea is to lock someone into an Apple One bundle, which then locks them into upgrading their hardware. Like, that's the idea, is the value perception of that bundle. Amazon really, you know, I've been thinking about this, really interesting. We think of Amazon Prime Video as an add-on to Amazon Prime in the United States, because we as a country, and in Canada and parts of Western Europe, we as a country spend a lot of our time shopping online. Like, e-commerce is actually a huge business in the United States. And it's not a huge business in other parts of the world where shipping is delayed, where they just don't have that type of infrastructure, whatever it might be. In other parts of the world, Prime Video is the thing you sign up for. It's the number one thing. And then you might buy stuff on Prime. But Prime Video is like the thing that you're doing. So for Amazon, what they're trying to do is really just create added value proposition. I mean, their number one leadership principle is customer obsession. Their whole thing is like, if we have something that people really love on the TV side, on the gaming side with Twitch, on the music side, whatever it might be, then maybe they spend not on the Prime side. But as long as they're paying, we can continue throwing stuff at them that they're then engaging with that either helps our advertising business or helps our subscriber business. To your exact question, I wanted to set that up, because to your exact question, how do you compete with that? They're trillion-dollar companies. They have more money than God three times over. Like, they can play in that game for as long as they want to play. And I think with Amazon, they're restructuring their strategy a little bit. So I'm excited to see what Prime Video becomes. And I would say like a year, year and a half, year and a half to 3 years. Because I think they're in a new development cycle. I think they're trying some new things. Apple very clearly would like to take from HBO. Like, very, very clearly would be like, hey, we're doing this. We don't necessarily need a library. We don't even need to be profitable. Like, we're going to sell 40 million iPhones in a month. Like, it's fine. But they want to be, you know, the brand. They want to be the prestigious thing that Apple is. They want to have the creative clout. They want to be at the Oscars and at the Emmys. And they do also want to be profitable. Like they do want to run a strong business. But the way that they want to do that is to kind of replicate HBO in the early, late 90s to early 2000s, right? They want that slate of like Sopranos, Wire, Oz, Sex and the City. And so they're willing to kind of spend on it to really make that happen. And I think they're looking at a company like Warner Brothers Discovery and saying like, they're going to have to take all these cost measurements. They're trying to deal with their margins that are like coming down and structuring all that. They're going to have to pass on some projects. And we want to be the company that brings it up. The more that you have stronger sentiment for a platform, the more that the value perception rises with each title, the more subscribers you get and the less churn you have. And they need that. Like they need just the good stuff month after month after month. And I think that's kind of where they're sitting and they're waiting and they're actively pursuing those speedways. But yeah, if you're any other company, good luck. If they really want to play in that field, like they will dominate.
Yeah. Julia, thank you very much. This is a fantastic show. Everybody should follow you on Twitter at Julia Loudmouth.
Yeah.
Wait, at Loudmouth Julia.
Yeah.
Sorry, backwards. And I always talk about how great Puck is. Puck and the Ankler, and those are the two kind of combo entertainment packages I read. So as always, recommended. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.